CFYLP is sponsored by CapturedPrey.com. Visit CapturedPrey.com today for all your import and third-party Transformers needs, and save even more through the Captured Prey Loyalty Program. You can also save on shipping on domestic orders of $150 or more. See website for details. CapturedPrey.com. Great toys, great prices, great service. Mega Toy Fan. Maximize your collection with MegaToyFan.com for all your vintage toy needs. You can also find Mega Toy Fan at popular robot and toy conventions year-round. Minimize your costs and maximize your collection with MegaToyFan.com.
Transformers for your listening pleasure, TFYLP for short. Join us and discuss the latest in Transformers fandom. Now, where did I put that chorus stop? Ratchet, if you'll take the chorus stop. Transformers, defenders of
truth, robots who fight in disguise. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Transformers for your listening pleasure, TFYLP, episode number 212. Recorded Friday, August 12th, 2016. I'm your host, Daron Land. With me this evening is Proto Man.
How you doing, guys?
Headmaster Don.
Hey, everybody.
Sergio Garcia.
Good evening.
And Jim Black.
Greetings, Internet.
Also joining us this evening is our special guest, screenwriter Flint Dilley. Welcome to TFYOP once again.
Hey, good to be here, guys.
We're going to be talking tonight with him briefly about the 1986 animated Transformers movie, which celebrated its 30th anniversary this past Tuesday, I believe. And it's hard to believe it's been 30 years. I mean, the movie has become iconic, to say the least. Flint, do you have what's your biggest memory you have about working on the film?
Oh, man, I got about 500 of them. You're reading my Facebook posts. You're seeing some of them. Yeah, dial that question in. I mean, you know, because there are a lot of them. They range from when, you know, when we started working on it to the final release, to the premiere. And frankly, beyond. I mean, it's all kind of interesting. What do you want to know about? What, like, the questions really want answered?
Well, Daniel, I think Daniel's got a good question.
Well, I remember I interviewed you, I believe it was BotCon 2011, and I remember I asked you, and it's never been repeated what you said because it was so fascinating, when I mentioned, like, you know, there was always that very strong connection between the 86 movie and Star Wars in terms of the way that the characters were, and you compared it to something related to football. And I found that really fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well, up. Basically what it is we had a bunch of new characters. And we're writing them. And, you know, and remember that, you know, what we got in the mail was a bunch of – sorry, I'm lying on my back in a deck chair in my backyard in Southern California. This is it's 6 o'clock at night. You guys, it's like night where you are, right?
Yeah, it's 9 o'clock here.
Yeah. Anyway, so so we had a whole bunch of new characters, and you had to pin them to something. That's what you always have to do with new characters, is you have to, find a way, a mnemonic, something to remember them by. And at the time, you know, because remember, I'm writing this in 1984, 1985. You know, the movie doesn't come out till 86, but you don't write it a week before the movie comes out, right? And so what I did, I was really, you know, I'm from Chicago, and the Bears were having a great season. If you know anything about football, the 85 Bears are still kind of a memorable team. And so I just based all the characters on 85 Bears. And so I thought of, you know, Hot Rod was Jim McMahon, and Cup was kind of Mike Singletary, and a little bit of Mike Ditka, and, you know, and so on. And that was an interesting way to start out. Obviously, they became their own characters. I always do when you've written them. And you put them in real scenes and all that, you know, Walter Magnus you know, ceases to be, you know, Gary Fenzik and starts being Ultra Magnus. But you have to start somewhere. So if I, basically, I just thought of them as 85 Bears.
That's interesting.
And I always wanted you to repeat that, because I remember when I recorded that interview, I was like, man, I want people to know about this, because it's always been so fast. Because everyone, they look and they go, oh, Hot Rod is Luke Skywalker, and Optimus Prime is the voice of Obi-Wan, and, you know, Galvatron is Vader and stuff. But it's like when you told me that, it was like that went right over my head. I was like, wow, okay, that's an interesting jumping point for like you said, before, like Star Wars obviously had its influence on everybody, especially by 84.
Yeah, it's impossible to imagine what my culture was in 85 without thinking about Star Wars. I mean, you can't.
Exactly.
It was Star Wars. But at the same time, we're all kind of sick of that. And you were looking for new influences. Not every character can be Luke Skywalker, and not every villain can be Darth Vader. And so we're just trying to find new stuff. And frankly, I was just more interested in the 85 Bears than I was in Star Wars at that particular moment.
I think a lot of people draw the similarities or draw the connection to Star Wars, but with the movie poster, which is very Star Wars-esque in its design. I think that's where a lot of people get that.
Absolutely. And, I certainly had nothing to do with the layout of the movie poster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bear in mind, all this stuff is done by a huge team, and there are a bunch of inputs, and every line of dialogue is read through by, three producers and two executive producers and a director, and, the actors, you tune it when the actor's there. So whatever your starting point is doesn't really matter. It's kind of where you end up. It's important.
Now, I was reading through your Facebook posts over the last week regarding the animated movie, and you had an interesting story or interesting thought on the origins of the planet of junk, where the Junkions are from.
Hold on, guys. I just turned my camera off. Told me I'm on low. I'm running out of power. Turn my camera on. If I suddenly disappear, I didn't get really upset and angry. It's just my camera. Yeah, we'll resume this later on. Yeah, sorry. The origins of junk. Well, I mean, I always thought of Junkion as being, it was like this big magnet. Think of a cross between a magnet and an electronic petri dish. And it sucked in all this space garbage and debris. So you have a big battle. And like all the ships and the parts and the guys in the battle and all that, suddenly get sucked into the same thing and, get sucked onto the planet. And then eventually it begins to generate life and, computers go back on and robots start, refunctioning again and stuff like that. And, and that created the Junkions. And they didn't have any, cultural bases. Their databases had probably been wiped. They had all their core operating systems. And so they started developing a culture based on whatever radio waves and language they randomly heard coming through the galaxy. Now, bear in mind that the idea that they spoke a language of junk, I mean, that was the whole idea, that their whole language was constructed from commercials that we've been broadcasting for 30 years that somehow made to the other end of the galaxy. Is it language based on junk? That totally smells to me of a Joe Bacall idea. Now, I don't know that because that pre-existed me. The idea that there'd be a Junkion and there'd be, characters that spoke junk. But I was just trying to make sense of it, and that seemed to be the kind of unifying theory that made all of that work.
Now, the death of Optimus Prime, how did that come about?
Well, that's what I was talking about in the blog post. Optimus, I mean, okay, there's the kind of business reason, and then there's the, how we wrote the scene. They're two different issues. The business reason was that, Hasbro, we didn't know that we'd created iconic characters that we'd be talking about 30 years later. It's 30 years ago. And that people really love these characters and they wanted to see them. We just figured every year we're going to come out with, 30 more Transformers, and everybody's going to forget about the guys from last year. And so we wanted to bring in new products because, Hasbro did. I mean, I had no real input into this. And so, and we're very used to working on the show. We'd be working away on an episode and we get a fax that said, oh, we've discontinued Ashtray and, you know, insert dipstick into the scenes. Ashtray would have been. And a lot of times Ashtray and dipstick, or throttle cable or, whoever the character was, would be very different characters. We just had to make it work. But we're very used to characters getting discontinued. And so the movie was just a big discontinue and a big introduction. Because, from Hasbro's point of view, they're trying to sell toys. They viewed the movie and the TV shows. The disparaging way of putting it is saying they viewed them as 30-second commercials. So that's not quite right. 22-minute commercials. But that's not right. I mean, they viewed them as a means of getting their toys out. Because Hasbro's in the business of selling toys. And the fact that the program became a big hit was just a happy bonus for them. But they, like any other business, they're being a core business. And so the idea of the movie was that you discontinue the 85 line and you bring in the 86 line. And we had, we knew we'd be bummed to kill Optimus and Megatron and all that. But we figured a few of the fans would be, but that's a good thing. And we didn't know we'd get the reaction we got. You never know. I mean, you can't assume that people know what reaction they're going to get from the marketplace. And well, frankly, and I've said this before, I mean, I would argue that we wouldn't even be talking about Transformers now if we hadn't killed Optimus Prime. That was sort of the moment everybody figured out that they really loved that character.
Well, if nothing else, it saved Duke's life.
Yep. Yep, and Optimus came back when we realized we'd made a mistake. All right, not even that we'd made a mistake, that we needed a course correction.
Well, it showed the importance of that character to a whole generation.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because, there's a reason nobody's talking about it. I mean, how many podcasts do you have about Mask or, any of the other shows that were, very GoBots? You had a lot of GoBots podcasts. And that's because there's an investment in these characters. And part of that is, people had to really decide, I'm bummed out that he's dead. And a lot of kids never forgot that.
Well, I think it also goes to say, too, so much throughout our fandom, people say they, Generation 1 isn't the end-all, be-all, and that all the Transformer lines that have come and gone since, that everybody has their G1. But whenever you look at the core of the Transformers brand, you always have to go back to the original characters that set the stage for what we have today. Even the live action films. If it weren't for you guys killing off Optimus Prime in the 86 movie, we wouldn't have 4 multi-million dollar live action films getting ready to have a 5th.
Yep. I totally agree with that. I think that, it was kind of, it sort of got people to recognize how much they liked that character and how much they cared about him. And it's a gutsy thing to do in retrospect. I mean, it's not like we were utterly unaware that this was going to have an impact. We wanted to have an impact. We just, didn't know the size and scope of it. You never do. You never release a product. A month ago we released Pokemon Go. Yeah, I work at Niantic Labs now. We had no idea it was going to turn into what it became. We knew it was going to be a successful game, and we knew we'd made a good, cool game and it would have a following, but how can you predict that? I mean, if people could predict that, everything would be a big hit.
Well, the one question I have is, when you read the script back then, and considering what was being released in terms of American animated movies at the time in theaters, did you think that the script was gutsy in itself in terms of, characters getting murdered and stuff? Because when you compare it to what was being released in terms of animation in America, let's ignore, Japan or Europe, where it was Disney or maybe, the odd indie movie that, got out. I think like Five Will Goes West, I think, came out around the same time, or maybe I could be wrong there.
Disney. I wrote that like two.
There you go. So,
But that wasn't indie. That was Universal Studios. I mean, it wasn't like, somebody made that in their garage. That was, Mr. Spielberg and Universal.
Yeah.
But, nobody really knew what that the territory was. I think maybe there was a Smurfs movie or a Care Bears movie or, you know, some really, you know, childish things. But, you know, we knew we were going into a world that had Star Wars movies, and we wanted to be that. That's why they put the obscenities.
But animation, okay.
Yeah, into the movie. Well, we just viewed animation as, at the time, unless you had $200 million, you know, in those dollars, you couldn't, there just wasn't the technology to do it in live action. You couldn't do a Transformers movie in live action. I imagine you could do it with miniatures or something, but we didn't know how to do that movie. So animation was the palette you had to paint on, but we didn't think it was necessarily children's medium.
Interesting. Okay.
And now, the truth is, when we looked at the demographics of who was watching our shows, it was during a recession. I mean, everybody forgets the mid-80s, there was a recession. And so there were a lot of people. The age, you know, his dad would come home and watch with his kids. And, you know, timing is a lot. Timing is extremely important properties. And so we came out in a time where we could attract an audience that wasn't the normal animation audience.
Cool.
Don, you had a question?
Yes, sir. Being one of the older Transformer fans on this podcast, I just turned 46 this year.
I vaguely remember being 46.
I was there in the theater, 16 years old, when the movie premiered, and I have to say it was an absolute shock in the first 20 minutes. I mean, just absolutely, just because season two is my favorite season of the early stuff,
right?
And you know, there's a, when this movie was under production, that it was probably well after season one, before season two. I'm not sure the timeline, but you know, that's why we had Devastator, but we didn't have anybody, any of the other combiners in there. Is there any big characters that you would like to have gotten into the movie, but you couldn't because of the way the timing was?
Well, I mean, you know, we had to get 135 characters in. Yeah, you know, because once again, there were 135 products, you know, I mean, and so we had to show everybody. And that was really all we could do to just get that stuff in. And you know, to get in what we got in. We could, I mean, I have no idea how you would have put more characters into that movie.
Yeah.
And really the problem, I mean, what I regret more is, not even regret, I mean, we just... All right, yeah, I'm good for about five more minutes. Sorry, guys, I'm getting harassed off screen. What there wasn't just enough time in the movie because the movie's only so long as it is to put in more on each character. I mean, most of the complaints we have is people didn't see a lot of certain characters.
I just was wondering because I have a lot of favorite characters from season two that I would have loved just because we've seen the storyboards with them on it, but the storyboards were cut and never animated. So
yes,
I was,
that is correct.
Yes, I was hoping at one point someone might have animated those storyboards and put them back into the movie, like for this anniversary this year.
No, animation doesn't work like live action. You don't shoot outtakes. You don't shoot masters, and you don't have. Yeah, live action, you start out with a master and you get that, and then you go in for all your shots. Animation is extremely efficient. You only get the shots you want. Yeah. So there's not, I mean, yes, they cut stuff, but you know, nothing significant. They cut 6 frames here and 4 frames there, but I don't know of any scenes that.
Well, I want a Lord of the Rings extended edition style.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, look.
3 hour 86 movie?
It would be a really worthy thing to do. I mean, there are two things that I'd like to do. One would be, go in now and, put in all that stuff. You know, all the stuff that we had. Yeah, because bear in mind, there were probably 20 drafts of the script. And so by definition, there are 20 drafts full of stuff that, of scenes that didn't make it into the movie. And a lot of them didn't make it in there because of time. A lot of them didn't make it in there because of focus and emphasis. And it'd be really fun to go find all that stuff and put it in there. The other thing I would love to do, but it won't happen in our lifetime, is I'd love to find the version of the script Jay and I wrote, which was called Secret of Cybertron. And it was we'd gotten the first Ron Friedman draft, which is not the draft you see on the internet. That was something different. I don't know quite what that was. That was some combiner hybrid draft. We'd gotten that, and you know, it was a warehouse of incredible ideas. Ron has an amazing imagination, and he probably had a laundry list of, you know, 500 things that all can't fit in the same movie. But the draft we got, we couldn't really understand it. And so we sort of took what we wanted, and then we wrote our own movie, which was The Secret of Cybertron. And I would love to do that as a graphic novel sometime. It won't happen because there are no existing copies that we can find of The Secret of Cybertron.
Maybe get with IDW and work on something like that.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to do. It's just, in my mind, it only works if we could find the real script. I'd love to see what we wanted to do in a universe where the current movie doesn't exist. If I were to go recreate it now, it would be 100% informed by the movie we actually made. And I couldn't really get back in that mindset. It can't be 1985 again in my brain, unless I've got some kind of save file in there. I don't know. that's what I'd love to see. I mean, a lot of it came out early on in the third season. Not wasn't stuff from Secret of Cybertron, but it was ideas we had that just didn't make it. I mean, if you really get past the animation, which kind of, sorry, Five Faces of Darkness. Get past the animation of Five Faces of Darkness and get to the ideas. That was pretty much, you could interpolate pretty well what we wanted to do.
Yeah. Season 3 is its own unique creature when it comes to the animation studios and everyone else involved. It's just...
Keep your hate to yourself, Don.
No, I'm not.
That's
I'm not,
my favorite
I'm not hating
season
it.
Now.
I'm not hating. I'm just saying.
Season 3 is and always has been extremely controversial. There were a lot of, you know, it was the post movie season. You know, certainly, and I was there. I was like weirdly around on it, you know, because you know I wrote the miniseries at the beginning. You know, plotted out most of the episodes. We had a pretty good season arc idea. Came back at various different points and did things because I was still a producer on it and a story editor, but I was really off doing Inhumanoids and probably the beginning of Visionaries then, you know. So
I have to say, sir, is one of my favorite series of Hasbro has ever done. I love Visionaries.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, I think Visionaries. Okay, I am detecting you're an animation connoisseur, and that matters to you because Visionaries is by far the best looking show we ever did. And that's Tokyo Movie Shinsha did it. You know, it wasn't. And they were really trying to prove themselves. They were a great team. And so it has just an enhanced look. I mean, they were, you know, those guys were incredible. And that's, I'm not taking anything away from anybody else. You know,
Jim, they had a question?
Yes. I was just curious, you know, that just kind of branch off a little bit from what Don was talking about with the storyboards. I was wondering, you know, we were talking about some of the kind of the previously taboo things that was incorporated into a kid's movie. Things such as like the profanities or killing off, you know, a main hero character like Optimus Prime or Wheeljack or some of them. And it got me thinking. I remember a while back hearing some stuff about the death of Ultra Magnus on the planet of Junk, and you know how the sweeps, you know, came in and they saw to his demise. And,
right.
But in the storyboards, if I recall, it was originally some kind of like laser ropes or something that would actually latch onto Magnus, and he would be literally drawn and quartered there. Just screaming agony.
Yes,
I was wondering, the audio in that, was the audio that Robert Stack recorded, was that actually of that scene? Or did he record that of, you know, him just being shot? Because it's just... I've always wondered, because it sounded a little odd for that scene.
I don't remember. I'm not saying you're wrong, and that's an invalid theory. But my feeling is that by the time Robert Stack was showing up in the studio, we pretty much had our script and our scene. And we were working the storyboard. So I don't think there was like some other version of it that they pulled back.
Okay.
What I wholeheartedly believe is that there were scenes where he was drawn in quarter. I mean, what's funny is, you know, bear in mind at that point, we weren't thinking of this as a children's movie. And very consciously, the obscenity was in there to make sure we got a PG rating so mm-hmm. that we didn't look like a G-rated movie. I mean, like, I never typed the obscenity into a script. That was never there. Okay, that was only interpolated, you know, put in later on as to, it really is a marketing concern.
Okay.
And they, we just didn't want to be in the G ghetto because we knew nobody over, you know, six would go see a G movie. And PG-13 had just been invented at that point. And we didn't, I don't know that we really wanted that. We certainly didn't want R. I don't know how we would have gotten R, but, you know, theoretically we could have. But we did not want to be perceived as a little kiddies movie.
Okay.
And I mean, but what I will tell you is in the lost version of the script, the basically entire 85 product line that wasn't being continued was wiped out in one massive charge of the Light Brigade, where the Autobots were, they had to get the Autobot Matrix into the center of Cybertron, because Cybertron transformed and he fought Unicron at the very end of the movie. I mean, it was these two monstro planet-sized giant robots tearing each other apart with the surviving Autobots and Decepticons tipping the balance, right? That was the version Jay and I did, you know. So imagine what the reaction would have been if these kids, I mean, if we were just going for it, we figured, you know, these toys are finished anyway, so we might as well, you know, just right. have this, you know, trip to Valhalla for all of them. And, you know, we thought the better of that, but, you know, sometimes you write a draft knowing that's not what the movie's going to be, but you want to go to the furthest extreme end and smartly pull it back as opposed to writing the safe script. So that's what Secret of Cybertron was. But, yeah, you know, Optimus Prime was just the beginning in that version of the script. It was the Wild Bunch.
Fantastic.
Or the 300 Spartans or the Alamo or whatever, you know, it was that.
Sergio, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. How closely did you work with the voice actors?
Extremely closely. I mean, certainly in the movie, you know, we had some recordings in New York, and I was back, I believe, for a couple of them. I mean, you know, I have trouble, you know, 30 years ago. But, I mean, certainly all the L.A. recordings, I mean, we were here, you know, we went in every day, we sat through every take of every actor, and I mean, that's, you know, that's like shooting a movie. And, you know, a director, I mean, Wally Brewer is a voice director, but that's not like a director in a feature film. You know, I mean, animation's just a different medium, and so, you know, he would get the performances and all that, but we were very much in the room making sure that we, you know, we talked to the actors for a long time. I mean, Robert Stack was a great example. Great guy. And Robert Stack was my geek hero because when I was a kid, like, my mother would let me watch The Untouchables. It was a really big night, right? So I'm sitting there with the real Elliot Ness. And he was an incredible guy. But, you know, we had to explain to him who Ultra Magnus was and, you know, what he did and why these scenes mattered. I mean, he may have read the script, but, you know, a real person in 1985 can't read a Transformer script and have any idea.
What
this looks like.
That's kind of how society's changed. You know, Transformers as a iconic name has permeated culture to the point now where if you say, oh, that's a Transformer, people know exactly what you're talking about. Yep. But back in 1985, it was still a really new concept, and I'm sure there's plenty of people that really hadn't got a hold of what it was, and many of those were actors, like you said, Robert Stack.
Robert Stack would have had, unless he had grandchildren that played with Transformers, Robert Stack would have had no idea whatsoever who Ultra Magnus was or what a Transformer was or anything. I mean, because it's all brand new then. Right now, Transformers is a third generation franchise. In other words, you know, the kids know about them, their parents know about them, and the grandparents are the people buying Transformers for what are now parents. You know, so there's nobody, you know, you got three generations to pass on the lore, and, you know, mom and dad now are well aware of who Optimus Prime and Megatron and all that are. And grandma and grandpa even know this stuff because they were buying it for their kids. That's totally different than 1985 when, you know, if you didn't happen to watch the show, you had no idea what Transformers were. Yeah, and you have to think about it in that context. Yeah, I'm sure the parents had no idea why the kids are bummed out that a semi-truck died.
How awkward was it trying to explain to someone like Robert Stay, okay, so your character is a semi-truck?
I mean, they knew that. I mean, these guys were smart and hip. I mean, they knew the basic. We had the toys in the recording studio, you know, so we could show them what they looked like if their toy was released. We didn't have prototypes, but, you know, then we could show them pretty much what a Transformer was and how they worked and all that. And, you know, and these guys are pros. I mean, I'm sure Robert Stack walked in, knowing what a Transformer was, but he certainly probably would not have known nuances, and he certainly wouldn't have known how to play that differently than any other kind of a character. And at some level, it didn't really matter because, you know, the actors don't really do much when they, you know, the actual actor doesn't really have to know if he just transformed into a semi-truck.
The late Orson Welles, a listener, Edward Hunt, says here on Facebook, he said Mr. Welles was quoted as saying he was playing a giant toy that was killing smaller toys.
And then I don't know that he said that. I remember him saying, so I play an entire planet. You know, and Orson Welles at that point looked like an entire planet. Orson Welles was a big guy. So I mean, I'm 6'5", and he was eye to eye with me. And he weighed about 450 pounds. Okay, so he looked like a planet walking in, you know, in there. But I got to tell you, he was great. You know, that was one recording where I think a lot of people weren't there. And, you know, because, you know, it was rumored that he treated actors kind of badly. And, I mean, sorry, you know, the production people badly. And nobody wanted to get, because that was this tape that would be passed around from all the voice, you know, there was no YouTube then or no internet. You can hear it on YouTube now. And, you know, nobody wanted to get a wedgie and, you know, in a recording session to look stupid. But, you know, like I had to be there because, like, it was okay if I looked stupid. And I'd already met him before. Though, you know, we didn't really refer to it. I'd met him before with Gary Gygax. We were trying to get him to do a Dungeon Dragon movie. And, you know, he was great. He didn't do anything rude to anybody. He wasn't sorry. He was, you know, he was not healthy. He died a week later. And, you know, he had kind of a wheeze and, you know, he was in a wheelchair when he came in, and then he used a walker, and then finally walked the last couple of steps to the chair. But, you know, so, I mean, you know, he was, he was spot on. He did the stuff. He got the character. He seemed to have fun playing a whole planet, and it was a great experience. While we were waiting, I talked to him about Mercury Theater, which is his radio company that I think it was also his movie company. We were talking about his radio shows. He was great.
So, Sergio, you had a second part to your question?
Yeah. So I read online.
Sorry, you're going in a little in and out a little bit. If I suddenly disappear, I'll be getting battery warnings, but don't think I got deeply upset about it or left or something. But yeah, say again.
I was reading online that the scene where the Decepticons were invading the Autobot ship.
I'm not hearing anything.
He can't hear you, Sergi.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we just got a bad connection.
Yeah. Can you hear?
Maybe my.
And I think.
I'm going out.
It's possible that your connection is being interrupted right now. We can hear you. Okay.
I can hear you now.
Yeah, it's probably just a connection interruption there. Sergio, go ahead.
Okay. I was reading online that one of the more controversial scenes was when the Decepticons invaded the Autobot ship. In the earlier drafts of the script, was it one point more violent, or did that scene unintentionally come out violent, is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I mean, nothing unintentional happens in animation. You know, I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, somebody has to draw it and you have to think about it and you see it in storyboard and all that. So, you know, it's all, one thing that's great about animation is all 100% deliberate. You know, you don't have an actor on the set suddenly, you know, refuse to do a scene, or you don't have it suddenly rain in an exterior shot and you have to now rewrite the scene for rain. It's animation. Everything is very consciously there, and you've gone over it 100 times. But I thought that scene was actually pretty brutal when you have, you know, Megatron killing a guy lying down on the ground and finishing him with an arm cannon. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, I don't know what your violence standards are, but that's pretty hard.
Don, did you have another question?
The only thing I can think of is, do you have any, as far as, well, I really can't phrase it that makes sense. I have a question, but I can't formulate it into a sentence where it sounds.
Just put it badly. I'll try to figure out what it is.
Okay. Of all the shows you've worked on, the movie, you've worked on Visionaries, you've worked on some G.I. Joe, you worked on Transformers, with all the Hasbro properties, which one are you the happiest with the way it turned out?
We might have lost.
He said he had some battery.
If he comes back here, we'll. The 86 movie, Daniel, you had a thought that you was going to ask him.
Well, one thing that I was going to ask him was I was curious. Because he mentioned that he was present for Orson Welles' recordings, and I was wondering, because there's always been a heavy rumor.
I was thinking the same thing, but I figured he might not know.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering if Orson truly did complete all his lines, or did Leonard Nimoy actually did stand in for him?
Orson completed every line.
Supposedly, that's why. So I'd like to hear from the Orson. Well,
Sue Blue herself attested to that a few years ago. Because someone asked her, I don't know if it was at a BotCon or when it was, but she said that she was there, and Orson Welles recorded every single line for Unicron. That he fought his way through it. So,
also, now we know.
Yep, and knowing is half the battle.
But
do we get Vince DiCola to play the death of Flint's battery or?
But Flint, you can't die.
Do not grieve.
Yeah. Soon, hopefully, he will be one with the Matrix. Well, we'll hopefully he'll be able to rejoin us here. But if not, want to thank Flint for the time he was on here. He was also on here a couple of years ago. So we also have a full episode of Just Flint Dilly. I can't remember the episode number. I'll have to go back and look. But you can look back on the TFYLP archives and find an episode of Flint Dilly. And I also want to take this opportunity, since we didn't get to earlier, to mention our sponsors, CapturedPrey.com. Great toys, great prices, great service, great where you can save even more on the customer loyalty program, as well as $150 free shipping on orders of $150 or more, CapturedPrey.com. Also, Mega Toy Fan. Maximize your collection while minimizing your cost with Mega Toy Fan. Lots of great vintage toys, new and old. You can find Mega Toy Fan at the biggest robot and toy conventions year-round, such as TFCon USA coming up in October. Check out Mega Toy Fan. Maximize your collection while minimizing your costs. But the 86 movie, though, I think it goes without being said, and Daniel and I were actually talking about this. I mean, it was a hallmark of our childhood. And Flint said while he was talking there, yes, it was episode 99 that we had Flint Dilly on. So look up episode 99 if you want to hear more of Flint. But, you know, the 86 movie, whenever it was almost a coming of age for me, whenever I actually, before that I was into He-Man and Hot Wheels and Transformers had really latched on to me, but I still had these other toy lines that had my interest. But when the 86 movie came along, I didn't get to see it in the theater. I wasn't one of those that it was actually even showing nearby. I think at the time I was living in South Florida, and the closest theater they're showing it was, I believe, in Miami, and I lived on the opposite coast, so it wasn't an easy view for me. And my mom and dad wasn't going to go drive 80 miles to take me to a movie, So I didn't get to see it until they broke it up into five parts on the television show.
The unofficial season five.
Yeah, the unofficial season five. And I remember seeing that on the air, and I'm like, wow, this is just – I mean, it took the franchise to a whole nother level for me. I mean, you had these – the Autobots and Decepticons, and now they've taken their adventures into space, and these designs like Hot Rod and Scourge, at first it was laughable, this giant bar of soap that flies through space, essentially, but the design was cool. The cool design of Cyclonus, Galvatron going from a handgun into this giant fusion cannon. I just loved it.
And not to mention just the animation boost that it had, because you look at what Sunbow Entertainment was doing with season one, season two, and then you look at the 86 movie, and that's Toei was involved. There's a lot of different Japanese studios that were involved with this one, and how gorgeous it looked. You know, the animation, the battles, the choreography. Even look at the coming of Optimus Prime against Megatron, and just the choreography of that fight and the animation. And when Megatron, he jumps in the air and you have him eclipsing the sun, just all those really amazing high spot animation scenes that the 86 movie gave.
Yeah, we wouldn't see anything along this level until probably Call of the Primitives, which was another TNS. Call of the
Primitives, which was, again, a Japanese-influenced episode. So, I mean, it was incredible what was churned out. Because, the reality is, you look at probably the only other counterpart that you could compare in that same timeline would be, like, say, the G.I. Joe movie. And while it did have that amazing opening.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That amazing opening, which, again, was also a big – but I found from a design standpoint, it still was very true to the original Real American Hero seasons that came before it. But there was a little bit of an animation boost there. Not a big one, the Pythona scene where she's, jumping through the closing – for anyone who saw the 87 G.I. Joe movie, if I'm not confusing everyone. But, there was an animation boost there too, but I found that the difference between Season 2 G1 to the 86 movie was gargantuan.
Oh, yeah.
It was just like a shot of steroids to everything that Transformers was up to that point. And it was absolutely gorgeous. And, it's a credit to Flir O'Deary and his designs, because up to that point, Flir O'Deary was basing a lot of his designs that were in season one, season two off of toys, where season three, he was able to actually have that freedom and, design stuff without the confines of a toy. And the toys were actually designed afterwards from his stuff. So that's why a lot of the toys were kind of like hit or miss in terms of how they looked on the screen, as opposed to a lot of the 86 toys, how they looked in plastic or die cast in this case. Well, that's why we had those more sleeker designs, ignoring the Diclone origins of Ultra Magnus. But the case of Hot Rod, Cup, RC, Blur, and going forward with that, even with the Junkions and Wheelie, that you just had it was a whole different design. There was a whole different, kind of design aesthetic that it was going into. You still had those Diclone and Microman designs, but here they were next to these more sleeker, almost going like, where does the kibble go? Kind of designs. So just incredible, really.
Well, for me, seeing it in the theaters, again, being old and I was there when it came out, was just this, just this incredible, even then, it was like Mr. Dilly said, and this was a very polite, I appreciate the compliment. He said I was an animation connoisseur. And I guess I've never thought of that phrase, but I am, cause I've Transformers the movie is, I think what got me to realize animation was more than just cartoons on the television. It was something you could tell a story with. And even back then, I recognized it, even if I couldn't put it into words. And I'm sitting watching this on the screen, and it's like this epic, just – it blew my mind because the scope of it. And I love season two is my favorite season because there's so many good stories. God Gambit, Starscream's Brigade. You know, there's so many, you know, like that. Season 3 has so many great stories too, like The Burden Hardest to Bear. You know, that's a good Rodimus story. You've got, you know, Carnage. No, I'm kidding, and I'm of course not.
Carnage.
yeah, and but that's, the animation
that's just
is
a good laughable story.
Yeah, but it's the animation quality that really hurt season 3 from being a storytelling season. As far as, but your episode focus, your plots, Call the Primitives, Burden Harness to Bear, Web World. God, Web World was just incredible. Dweller in the Depths. Mm. One of the creepiest Transformer stories just ever. You know, so many good stories, but the animation was, and I think a lot of people was that drop, as incredible as it was from season 2 to the movie. From the movie to season 3, I think is where a lot of the hurt comes for season 3.
And not to point fingers, but it was Nelson Shin really that kind of led to that, because after the success, I guess internally, of the 86 movie, it was then Nelson Shin that made his bid to bring season 3 to his studio. And well, you know, the hit or miss results that came of it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Antoine Lewis had a great question on YouTube. I just now saw it. And I'd love to ask Flint this too. Why is it necessary, or why was it necessary, to change Megatron into a whole new character as Galvatron when he could have possibly evolved, or rather gotten an upgraded body, but not be reformed into Galvatron? Could it be because the new toys were coming out? I'm sure that is the answer why why we got Galvatron. But I mean, I don't see a reason why they couldn't have just continue to call him Megatron, just in a new toy, new form. What do you guys think about that?
I think you're right, Dernan, because the way Flint was talking and the way it's been talked about through the years, the mentality at Hasbro was like, we've had these toys, we've had these characters for 2 whole years. They're old. They've had their time. We need new product. Keep the line fresh. Clean across the board for all the major characters, even if they could have probably cherry picked some.
If you look at
it, just
it went through three and well four seasons, but really three and three episodes. But it went for 4 years. 4 years Generation One lasted. Well, actually, a little bit longer than that if you stretch out the G1.
The comics.
Into the comics and everything, because you went into 89 and 90. But, you know, as far as the cartoon, the animation is concerned, it went for 4 years. Whereas ever since then, with the exception of maybe Beast Wars, and every iteration of Transformers has only lasted 1 year, you know, with the animation, and then it's just fresh restart with the next thing.
Yeah, as time progressed, it seemed that, and this isn't just Transformers, but most big brands in general, the lifespan of brands tend to, they used to have, like, there used to be, like, Star Wars got their 4 years, you know, then Transformers got their 4 years, the Ninja Turtles got their 4 years, and then when you kind of started hitting the 90s, stuff started to trickle down to 2-3 year, you know, lifespans before the next new hot thing. You know, whether it be, if you want to jump in the Pokemon, Digimon, X-Men cartoons during Marvel's boom during the 90s, the Batman series with DC, you know, everything kind of usually had 3 seasons at best, you know, maybe a 4th if they were lucky. Like you mentioned, Beast Wars was, you know, you can kind of look at it like, you know, you could almost look at Beast Wars like 5 seasons in a sense, if the intent was of Beast Machines not so much to be a continuation, but just to be a new product. Which, you know, considering what was going on back in the day with Mainframe Entertainment.
Well, I actually see the 86 movie. See, like, Generation 1 would have possibly just ended after the 85 line. But the 86 movie was like, okay, we're going to take these characters and bridge them over to this new series. And you'll see some of the same, the characters from these old, this old series, but this is a whole new line of Transformers, which and essentially is what it would.
And bridge them over with an extremely ambiguous move, which was a humongous time jump.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's all the, you know, where you could go like, wow, then what happened to Chip Chase? What happened to Carly? What happened to so many characters? Because, you know, robots, yeah, you know, we learned that from the first episode, ageless, you know, mm-hmm. 4 million years passed, they're all good to go. The second that you know, second Mount St. Helen gave a little bit of a rumble. But, you know, you look at, you know, season two going into season three, and, you know, like Don said, there were so many episodes he loved. And then, you know, you almost go to yourself like, all right, so, you know, make tracks. You know, what happened to Raul? You know, what happened to, you know, all these characters that you could have going into season three. But season three obviously had a very different approach, where season two was Earth and what's going on Earth and Earth culture and fleshing out those 85 product characters with their individual episodes, aptly named after some of those 85 product characters, whether it be Make Tracks or, you know, Hollywood Hoist. It sounds almost like a wrestler. But anyways, the point being is where you went into, you know, the movie was, okay, we're going to kind of leave Earth. And it really signifies that when it's like, get to the shuttles, they leave Earth. And then that really signifies the overall arcing theme of what would go into season three, which is like everything is aliens and space and unknown cultures and anything but, where, I mean, I think there was only one episode to my knowledge of season two that really touched on the ideas of alien cultures outside of Transformers, to my knowledge. Yeah. Trying to remember if there was any more than that.
Well, season two also had episode written by Buzz Dixon, God Gambit.
Yes, God Gambit. Well, that's the one. I'm trying to think of another that really touched on that.
Child's Play was out in the if you mean like out the galaxy kind of thing, away
from
Earth.
Yeah, you're right. It's true, when they were shrunk down. You're right.
No, yeah, and the Gambler, which is one of my favorite episodes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were really like going out there, where now it was like like Flint said, like there was clearly an influence at that time from Star Wars. You know, they're like, where, you know, you're practically with season three walking into a cantina scene where it's just here's everything. Here's just every possible alien design under the sun that we could throw at you, with a lot of the aliens, especially like anything from you know, like you'll have like Carnage in C minor, and you have like a whole culture of people that sing, you know, and it have a very, very Spock-like kind of design to them, although with pink skin and stuff. But it was very interesting to see that evolution that existed, and the 86 movie really brought about that, because up to that point, they never left the solar system unless they were going to Cybertron.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, for listeners who are joining in late and seeing the episode title, it's like, where's Flint Dilly? Well, if you joined us earlier in the episode, you would have caught him. He was on for the first 35 to 40 minutes, but he was joining us via mobile and his phone died. So hopefully he will rejoin us here shortly. But if not, we're continuing our discussion of the 86 movie, the 30th anniversary. And we apologize that he had to drop so suddenly, but he did answer some great questions here for us. We each got a question in and got it answered. But, you know, going as to you know, talking back about the Beast Wars to the Beast Machines, it almost seems like we could have had a Beast Machines or Beast Wars the movie, which would have been really cool, I think. But a Beast Wars, the movie that would have spanned the gap from, okay, season three of Beast Wars to season one of Beast Machines, and explained why we had a talking plant, on Cybertron and everything. But I think the 86 movie, though, as a defining moment for children from our generation. You know, the death of Optimus Prime, I'll never forget. I mean, I didn't see it in theaters, but I heard about it from my friends. It was something that created a buzz among the fans of the franchise. I had a friend of mine who did have a parent that did take him to Miami to see it, and he came back and told all of us, okay, you know, the movie was great, but there's a lot of these characters that we'd never heard of before. There's Hot Rod and Cyclonius, and that's what he thought his name was at first. And this Galvatron, Megatron becomes his character.
I always found that fascinating too. Is I remember years ago, this was on ATT back in the day. I remember someone presented the idea. They were like, imagine you watched like season one and season two of Beast Wars. And then when season three came around, Cheetor, Dinobot, everyone was put aside and a whole new cast was put forward. And the main focus from that point on, I'm pretty sure a lot of people would have not been happy. And that's why, like, when we look back today, we go like, man, like, you know, what happened to Transformers? Why did it die out so quickly after 86? And I think that and this is like me playing devil's advocate, because as a humongous Hot Rod fan, it's like, wow, why would you say that? But at the same time, it's like, I could understand the perspective of fans of season one and season two, where, you know, you were so emotionally attached to those characters that imagine all of a sudden now all of those were swept under the rug, and you were now put in the situation where now you got to be invested in these characters. Because I mean, the only way people were able to experience that today, at the time when I'm this post on ATT happened, was when Beast Wars was out. It was like, imagine if, you know, Primal was killed, Cheetor was put aside, Rat Trap was put, all these characters were put aside, and a new line of product was put out, and we would never really revisit those old characters again. Maybe once in a while Cheetor might get a line and become Gold Cheetah, you know, at some point, but in general it would have it would have not happened. And you would obviously possess resentment for this new crew of Transmetal 2s or something, whatever they would have done back then to be that bridge of a gap.
Would have been the mutants.
Or the mutants even, you know, like whatever it would have been, you know, or you throw in some Animorphs in a crossover, you know, I don't know.
And Cup would still have his mutants
back then. But yeah, it's just like, I could understand the resentment that a lot of people had for season. Because like for me, unfortunately, you know, and I say it unfortunately, was I was introduced to Transformers through the 86 movie and forward, where I didn't have an emotional attachment to all those characters that were killed. So it was a little different for me, my first experience, where I could understand it, though, completely from people that, you know, just 13 episodes of G1 would have been enough. You forget season two, as much as you love it, Don. But I mean, just watching season one alone and going into the 86 movie, you would have been furious of everyone that was lost just from that, you know.
Yeah,
just already like Ironhide dying or Brawn or Prowl or Ratchet, characters that were very fleshed out in season one, and to top it off, Optimus Prime and a throwaway of Wheeljack and Windcharger, and then just going forward from there, that's enough already for people to be angry. But then to continue on with the season two and even more emotional attachment and more episodes and more appearances and more character development, and then thrown into that, I could totally see why Transformers kind of had a downturn at that point. And I mean, I always say to people, like, the one thing that was very fascinating about season three was that you watch season one and two of G1, and Optimus Prime is only absent in one episode, and that was Starscream in King Arthur's Court. Every single episode, Optimus Prime was present in some way. Maybe he had only one line, but he was there. Only one episode, he was completely 100% absent, season one, season two. In season three, Rodimus Prime is absent from almost 50% of the episodes, where Ultra Magnus almost was the forefront leader character. Ultra Magnus actually appears in more episodes than Rodimus Prime does.
I never realized that.
Yeah, well, that's just my stupidity of focusing on that stuff, going like,
That's because he can finally deal with that now.
Yeah, well, there. But you know what it was, and it makes me almost question really what really was the major intention with Ultra Magnus from the get-go, if anything. You know, with the concept of the city commander character, because you look at it, Ultra Magnus is designated city commander, But if you look at the old Galvatron toy, he's designated city commander.
Yep.
So it almost makes me wonder sometimes if Rodimus was a later addition to the script or to the idea of becoming the next leader instead of, say, Ultra Magnus was. You know, if Ultra Magnus was intended from the beginning to – maybe not the beginning, but say script number five or six to be the carryover leader permanently, and that there was no – you know, because it was Hot Rod and then old Hot Rod because of the old animation cells that he mentioned Ron Freeman, who was the very first script writer that Ron Freeman was playing off of. So,
incidentally, Ron Freeman is credited – in the movie as writing the movie, but
yeah,
as
the screenwriter.
He actually wrote the original script that was pretty much not used, I guess.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Flint mentioned, because the one that is floating around that Ron is always said to be attached to was the one that doesn't involve Optimus Prime dying at all. So, I mean, that's the right away there. If Optimus Prime wasn't intended to die in the first script, instead it seemed like he was, you know, no spoilers to anyone who didn't read the script yet, intended to combine with Cybertron and for it to transform. That was kind of the original concept of that script. But again, if that was the fifth script, the second script, we never really have numbers on these that are confirmed. But so right away you have early scripts where Optimus doesn't die, later scripts where he does. And then there's conflicting stuff from Japanese media where Galvatron was a separate character, then Galvatron was meant to be the same character. Makes me wonder, you know?
Well, I mean, it's almost like as far as the toys were concerned, they were in the bios that were written for them, Ultra Magnus was meant to be more of a new lieutenant for Optimus Prime or something, and Galvatron to be a subservient.
Yeah. But as far as the toy commercial, they're doing the voiceover work for the Ultra Magnus commercial, and he says Peter Cullen is doing the voice of Optimus, and he says that I basically transforms into my powerful Autobot commander. So when I first saw the commercial for Ultra Magnus, it's like, is Prime being replaced as leader?
That's something that I've always found fascinating, because it's just that designation that they did, because Hot Rod, or well, specifically the Rodimus Prime toy, was just Protector. You know, that's all it was, which could be interpreted in any way. You know, that could be interpreted in any way. That could be, he could be an Alpha Trion character for all we know, you know, like, or an evolution of that. But ultimately, we never really, you know, like, and it's funny because I've asked different sources in person, being OCD that I am when it comes to that character. Like when I met Bob Ugansky, I asked him, like, how much input did you have on that character? And he said very little to none. He was more of an 84, 85 guy when it came to writing the Bible, where 86 was kind of out of his hands at this point. And that's where then Flint comes in and, you know, mentions, you know, the connection to the Chicago Bears and stuff, where there was that kind of early beginnings with that stuff of the creation of those characters. So, I mean, it would be always interesting to know what came for, you know, that chicken of the or the egg kind of situation, which really came first.
Yeah. My only regrets about the 86 movie is – basically, it pulls the Matrix out of its butt, and it's gone on to be the ultimate MacGuffin.
Well,
but I always wish, like, you know, when I mentioned to Mr. Dilly earlier, I always wish they had gone back for these anniversary editions and had put back in, because see, they did this for Doctor Who, for a lot of the missing episodes. They either animated or did steals with overall narration, but they put some of the missing scenes back in, so you got the complete story. You know, the dialogue may have existed on recordings, but there was no video, so they just did a still image of the scene, something like that, to try to sort of flesh out the movie a little bit, so you just don't pull this MacGuffin out of nowhere.
The Matrix has always been something that's controversial, because when you have episodes like Prime Target, where it's like, we're going to scan Optimus Prime and this clone and find out which is the real one, they are exactly the same. Well, You know, assuming that Megatron made a perfect, you know, identical matrix inside the clone, you know, you know, there's always been stuff like that. Same thing when they were, you know, they were working on the inside of Prime's chest and God, what episode was that? I think it was Countdown to Extinction. No, which episode was that? Or Laserbeak almost kills Prime.
Dividing and conquer.
We have episodes where he's like literally like on the operating table, opened up, man, and like, hey, no matrix, you know, like, so it's just something that it was an afterthought. And again, when you read the script, you know, you have so many things like, yo, he takes out his spark and it combines with everyone else's spark to make a bigger spark. And those are the early scripts. And then you look at the Marvel Comics adaptation and it has more of that coconut, you know, matrix shape design that they went with instead. And you actually see that in, you know, you watch the original 86 movie when Prime takes out the matrix. At first he's only taking out the spark crystal in the center, and that's an animation error that's present in the 86 movie. He doesn't take out the entire matrix out of his chest in that first animation image. He's taking out just the crystal, and then it becomes the whole matrix in that next shot that he then drops out of his hand. So if, you know, for people go back, watch the 86 movie, you'll see that. So it's, there's, you know, there's so much stuff that was on the cutting room floor, that God knows what was the original intentions.
Yeah. But when I said earlier to Mr. Dilley about wanting a Lord of the Rings director's cut version of this, that's what I've always wanted, is all the footage that was ever done. I have trouble with this. Animatics.
Animatics.
Animaniacs are Zany Tozomax.
Hello, Ratchet.
But I've always wanted to see all of that. Everything that was still either physically exists or can be recreated from memory, put back into the movie as best as possible, and we get a more complete picture of the snapshot of the movie at that time. It's impossible, I know, but I'm a Transformer fan. I want the impossible and demand it on a semi-regular basis.
Well, it's kind of IDW, when they did the trade paperback version of the adaptation of the 86 movie, not the four-issue version. They did a trade version where they actually included extra pages that were exclusive to the trade paperback version, which had, hey, where was Omega Supreme, Menasor? And they show that they were fighting at the Ark during the time of the 86 movie attack on Autobot City. So they, you know, they, and that was them trying to make sense of a mild plot hole that was present.
Right.
And you know, you could play off of that and go, well, then, you know, maybe down the line, you know, we'll have a movie. You know, the one thing is we've never – I can't really think of a major motion picture, even a minor motion picture, that was ever remade from the ground up with modern technology. We've had remakes, but we've never really had something where it's like, let's take an old movie and reanimate it from the ground up. And, like, I mean, that's always the dream, is like, wouldn't it be great if we take the 86 movie, take mainframes – you know, CG technology that existed back in, like, let's say when it peaked in 1998, and redo the 86 movie from the ground up, but with all the missing stuff that we wanted as, you know.
What I always wanted to see was, y'all remember, this was several years ago, that small blurb that Hasbro, that small commercial, they were always real to me.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the 2009 universe.
Yeah, it was several years ago. I didn't realize it was that old, though. At the time, I would have loved to have seen the movie redone in that animation. But holy hell, that would have cost God knows how much.
But I
definitely would love to have seen it. Because do y'all remember that? They were always real to me, that little – it wasn't a commercial. It was more like.
It's vague to me. It seems like it. I remember it, but I don't remember it. If that makes any sense.
It was the battle of Optimus versus Megatron in Autobot City.
Yeah, but just in. I'll see if I can't find a link for you, Daron, and put it.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. It was like the very early beginnings of the Optimus versus Megatron fight.
Yeah.
But you know, let's go back to how the introduction of the toys and how the 86 movie basically it was a changing of the guards on the store shelves as well, because even back in the 80s, distribution sometimes took a little while, and getting new toys out on the shelf sometimes, depending on where you went, you'd see old stock for a long time.
Oh yeah.
And back then we didn't have the internet. We didn't know what was coming. And like I said, I had a friend that went and saw the movie and came back and was telling us about these wondrous new characters and how they looked so awesome. And then, I remember over the course of the next coming months, I started seeing more of these weird looking cars and planes and everything show up in the stores. And I remember seeing Galvatron and I'm like, what? Wow, he looks like a giant generator or something. I remember the ones that caught my eye, Blur and Hot Rod. I loved the designs of them. Blur, I wasn't quite sure if he was a plane or a car, but I didn't care. He looked cool. Cyclonus. I still have my original Cyclonus. Blue ear Cyclonus, by the way. Nice. I just love the design of that jet. And then we started getting more of the stranger characters later on, like the Technobots. I mean, unique looking cars and jets and motorcycles.
Don't pick on my Technobots.
I have the Technobots sitting on my shelf right over here. Ha ha ha. But I mean, what did you guys, what was your experiences whenever the toys started hitting the shelves?
I remember being really disappointed in the Rodimus Prime toy. It just
no legs,
just
skinny legs.
Yeah, I remember getting it at. There used to be a chain down here called Zares. If anyone remembers Zares from back in the day, and I remember I picked it up at Zares, and I was just so really disappointed because I expected the trailer to be part of the body, like in the movie where it sort of like what Carrie eventually wound up doing with third party Carrie. And it was just, it was okay, but it sort of like when I bought God Bomber based on the toy catalog picture and not the actual real thing.
Your mental image of it did not match what was actually
exactly. What I thought I was getting is not what I got. But, I picked up most of my Transformers came secondhand from flea markets and yard sales and stuff. But I remember getting, I got Ultra Magnus secondhand, but I got a few in the stores, like Rodimus and Cyclonus. I think I got new in the store, and Scourge. And I was like, these are really cool because they were different aesthetics. They were space planes and space boats and stuff like that. And I really didn't have a problem with it because I knew back then, having been a collector for a little bit of time and having watched so much animation, I know they're trying to sell stuff. This is the new product. I knew that. But I was just disappointed that they weren't as epic as the screen kind of made them out to be.
What about you, Daniel?
Well, see, in Canada, we were always very short to get new product. Like television series, we got it at the same time as you guys. But when it came to toys, we were always kind of lagging behind. So when I saw the 86 movie, and I think also in Canada, the 86 movie, I think, maybe came out a little later because I remember it being a lot more fall than it was summer. And I asked my dad if I could get the red and yellow robot. I described Hot Rod to him. And my poor French Canadian father came back with Blaster. Mm-hmm. And that was my first Transformer as a result of that, because of what was available at the time. 85 G1 was plentiful in a line. Again, I'm going to lose every American listener here, but there was a chain here called Zellers, which is the equivalency of Target, I guess.
I've heard of Zellers, yeah.
It's like a Target equivalency. And, they just had tons of 85 product, but 86 didn't come until probably way into 87.
Well, actually, you know, Daniel, I can actually back that up because in 1986, I was on a French class field trip with my high school in Montreal and Quebec.
Hometown.
And we went to the Underground Mall in Montreal.
Eaton Center.
We were staying in a Holiday Inn, which was a huge Holiday Inn, the biggest Holiday Inn. I think we were on like the 30th floor. We had a view of the entire city of Montreal from where we were. And I remember there was a toy store down there in that, because you could hear the traffic.
Yeah, that's the Eaton Center. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
And this was 86. This was early February, March of 86. Cause I was 87. Cause I was a junior in high school, and all they had was Roadbusters.
Yep. They were very behind. And I remember then not too long after getting my first blaster, I remember with my mother going to stores. Cause my mom knew we're taking a trip near the toy aisle. It's going to be tough to leave without something, you know? So when I did get those opportunities, and I just remembered very vividly, long after I got my blaster, still seeing Astro Train, but no blur, no, you know, still seeing Astro Train, still seeing, who else was it that I like Cliff Jumpers, carded, you know, like there was, we were very behind. So like I actually, the amazing thing is I didn't get my very first Hot Rod toy until like 1997. Like years later in the secondary market, I remember, and again, this is going to date me with the online fandom, like staring at Starbase Rugby's website. And we're talking way before eBay, Starbase Rugby was one of the only places you could get used G1 stuff. And just staring at, I guess, his or her listings of these used Hot Rod toys and going like, oh, does she ship to Canada? You know, like... Because I'd never had a Hot Rod toy up to that. I literally, my G1 experience after the 86 movie was blaster, handful of MicroMasters. That was like, you know, literally for the longest time until Beast Wars rolled around.
Yeah.
It was a very weird experience for me because, I mean, a lot of you guys experienced G1 with season one, season two. Me, it was... season like 86 movies, season three onward, which then jumped into Ninja Turtles in that generation afterwards.
Yeah, but you know, yeah, at that store there was nothing but Roadbusters. I think I saw One Whirl, maybe.
There you go. That was Montreal back then. Like we were, and the reason for that, the logical reason before that was because the French, which is toys have to have French packaging. So it comes out first in the States, and then there's a mild delay. The truth is, pick up any of your Transformer toys today, like brand new ones, turn them over and look at the back of the packaging and you look at the bottom. It's going to say Longueuil, Quebec is where your packaging is made. All Transformer packaging is actually made in Quebec because they have to be made in English first, and then they're made trilingual or bilingual afterwards, but there's a delay. You know, there's a delay for – and Transformers specifically because they have bio cards, they have instructions. Yeah, right there. That's a perfect example. That's Generations right at the bottom. Quebec right there.
And I remember – I think it was Robots in Disguise 1.0 when we first saw trilingual on everything.
Aaron Archer, I believe he said they tried to start it permanently with Energon. If I remember correctly, they wanted to make it across the board with Energon where there was no distinction. American packaging, Mexico, yeah. Canada, we all had the same packaging with Energon. Armada was different. I don't remember what RID 1.0, though.
Because you had the multiple languages in different colors.
Yes.
In a lot of cases. So if when you look on the back of the card at your local KB when you're buying Megabolt Megatron, it's all – it's the three main languages.
Yes.
You know, and each one's in a different color.
Well, and also because Armada started the thing where they were packed in with comic books. And if I remember correctly, American releases only had the one comic where the Canadian releases came with and the international releases came with the one comic that was English. And then a second comic of the same comic that was French and Spanish. So, and there's the – as being shown over there.
Had it zoomed in on right here. Yeah, you can read it right there. That's what I'm.
Langueuil, Quebec, which is a small little island just above. Well, not really an island, but I'll say like a small little piece of land near Montreal, where all your packaging for Transformers is done in all of North America, and that's the main reason why we get delays here in Canada.
Yeah.
You guys get the latest wave of whatever. Let's say Titan Returns takes usually about, I would have to say, 2 to 3 months sometimes for it to show up in Canada because
of the sea Skylings.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Once in
a while, there's a freak occurrence, like a movie line will appear like in Canada before, or like a Prime first edition line. But in general, usually you guys get everything first.
Or your Toys R Us gets exclusives well before ours does. The problem is, y'all's currency is a little pricey.
Yeah, currency is a whole other story.
I do have a question. Sergio, you didn't grow up with G1 like we did. So you pretty much got it as here's a lump. You didn't see the progression from season 1, season 2 designs into season 3. It's like you just see it, okay, as a whole. What is your thoughts looking back on G1 and how the change came about? What are your opinions on it?
Well, since I didn't grow up watching it, you know, episode by episode, to me the change isn't as drastic to where, as somebody who grew up with G1, you know, after the movie, I don't know, where there's all these brand new characters, all the old ones are gone. Whereas since I learned about G1 well after I started collecting, it wasn't as weird for me as it would be for someone who grew up with it. Like, because I expected it to happen. It's kind of, I'm trying to explain it to the best of my ability. It's kind of hard to put into words what I'm trying to say.
In the sense that, like, I guess it didn't have time to marinate with you, so it didn't have as much of it, which is understandable. It's kind of those things like anyone who went into Star Wars that didn't experience it in theaters, you knew Vader was Luke's father way before even seeing Empire Strikes Back. And thus the shock is a different effect on you, if at all a shock, you know?
Yeah, and that's a good example too, because like I did watch Star Wars knowing that, you know, Luke, I'm your father. Everybody said that. It wasn't a surprise at all. But and I can relate that with Transformers, as I learned about G1 well after I started collecting, so I kind of knew everything that was going on.
So it's kind of like, okay, you have some Transformers that are realistic vehicles, some that are not, and that's the way it is. Whereas we grew up with, okay, we got realistic vehicles, cars and trucks and guns and tape players, and then all of a sudden, boom, what's this weird shit?
that was it. Is like, you know, we got fire chiefs that can drive Lamborghinis. A little out there, but it works. Mm-hmm. You got Trax, that's an actual Corvette.
If I'm not mistaken, in Japan, there are like...
It is based off of real stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. Well, and it's not so much a fire chief. It's just that what we know is Red Alert was dolled up to be as a fire chief. He actually is a legitimate police highway patrol, which is when there would be street racing on what's called the Shihogu, and the Wagon, which are two very famous strips in Japan where a lot of highway street racing would happen. The only way police could keep up with these street racers was to have these Lamborghinis or very powerful police certified vehicles. And that's why we have like Mach Alert in AKA as RID Prowl in Robots in Disguise, who is more that police Lamborghini that we're familiar with, which is on the highway chasing after Speed Breaker, you know, so, which is what he's more intended for. Just to cut in there, it's more so the reality of it is more so the departure of Daikon and Microman molds into original Hasbro molds, if anything, you know, that we're experiencing.
I remember thinking as a kid, because you're going from figures that have a lot of die-cast to figures that have little to no die-cast.
Well, if at any at all, in the sense of toes, you know, or the wheels.
And I remember it was the first time I recall as a fan referring to a toy that felt cheap. at the time, it felt like they were getting cheaper.
The reality almost of it is, because you look at 84, 85 toys, and, you know, I'll call a spade a spade. 84, 85 toys I found in the hands of most children would be more subjectable to breaking. Where I'll give the credit to the 86 toys. You know, Chrome Dome could take a throw to the wall, no problem. Where I'm pretty sure if you threw, like, Blue Streak at that same wall at the same veracity, he'd probably be in a million pieces. So I think you could kind of see what was written on the wall in terms of what they had intended with the 86 line, you know, with the exception of Ultra Magnus moving forward, where a little more sturdier. You know, keep in mind those Daikon and Microman molds, some of them dated from the late 70s going into the early 80s, like 81, 82. So they were also very dated, some 5-year-old or 4-year-old designs, where these were fresh 86 designs intended for a market that obviously safety tests probably changed within the 5 years of the creation of those 82, 83 Microman Daikon molds. So, you know, there's so many answers that you could only probably get from a Hasbro exec from that era, you know?
Yeah. Jim, what's your thoughts on the effects of the 86 movie as far as on the toys?
Well, as far as my original thoughts on the toys for the 86 movie, you know, or from that era in general, my original thoughts on those were, give me mine. I want that. Because I when the movie came out of theaters, I had been 3 years old for 4 days. But well,
you're a young pup,
right? Product of '83. But no, as far as my thoughts on the transition, though, you know, a lot of what Protoman said, you know, it makes a lot of sense because you do have, you know, these older molds, and all of a sudden, hey, here's some fresh stock. These new designs and whatnot. You know, and there's many factors. You know, one is, you know, the transition from die-cast metal to something that you couldn't bludgeon somebody to death with. You know, the loss of things like, you know, using less translucent plastic, as can be found in, you know, Prowl and Smokescreen, to you know, a more solid construct like Gnaw the Sharktagon. You know. The Sharktagon isn't going to snap as easily as, say, Prowl's windshield. You know, so, I mean, there's all kinds of factors. Guns were bigger, sturdier. You couldn't snap off the gun barrel quite as easily. But overall, I do think that, you know, the designs were vastly improved. I don't know if maybe toy safety regulations necessarily had as much of a hand in it. I mean, I suppose it could have. To some degree, but
sorry to cut you off. I almost question that because I always looked at, you had 84 Megatron, which was a gun, and it was very interesting that they went into 1986 with Galvatron with an orange tipped cannon. I always found that very interesting looking back now and going, was that intentional? You know, was there something that happened in 85 and 86 that was parlayed to the toy design? There was like, you know what, I think we need to go with something that, while it is a gun in a sense, because that 86 Galvatron toy has a gun mode, like it has a handle with a trigger, and that the fact that it has an orange tip, you know, just by design, if anything.
I don't mean that the toy safety was completely absent or anything. I'm just saying I don't know if it had as big a hand in that as, say, the transition to a lot of what we saw out of Generation 2.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, I think during that time period is when the safety rules really started kicking in, because during 84 and 85, you had Transformer figures with launching missiles, and then you get into the 86, 87, 88 stuff where, like, Magnus's missiles didn't fire and some other things.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if the movie toys would have been better if those that could have had launching projectiles still had the launching projectiles. Again, it's like you were saying, could that be something that we were missing from the toys that would have enhanced the play value that we didn't get because of the safety rules. I mean, see, that's not something new because that all started right after the unfortunate death in the late 70s with the rocket. Again, this is an urban legend. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but it's the child that choked on the Boba Fett rocket and passed away.
I don't think it's true because I've seen a couple documentaries on Star Wars figures, and from what I hear, the launching Boba never existed. So it might have been a different figure.
Yeah.
Our last question of the night I want to ask here is from listener Michael Reeser on Facebook. I apologize if I butcher your name, but he asks, any characters you would have liked to kill for the Do Not Kill list in the 86 movie? I'm sure there was a list. Okay, these characters are not getting killed. Any characters that you would have liked to have killed going in to the movie? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. There's not many G1 characters I hate. It's when you start getting into later stuff of Transformers.
Wheelie!
I don't even hate Wheelie. I don't really
Honestly,
he survived on his own on junk against seas of Sharktacons.
Quintessa, actually.
You know, yeah, exactly. I got to give him props for that, you know? I don't know if Bumblebee would have fared as equally successfully. So yeah. I don't know.
I got to say one idea as far as the character to possibly kill off that you wouldn't have previously thought of that I think would have really had a large shock factor to it would be had they maybe put Omega Supreme in the movie after all for him to be completely destroyed irreparably and not you know have you know spark plug and I have to be able to just rebuild him overnight or anything. I mean just
it's like the Decepticons have the Decepticons knock off one of the biggest Transformers that we knew of to date.
Right. Well yeah. You know, one of the most powerful, you know, biggest, you know, just like maybe Devastator like grabs his arm, rips it off and shoots him with it or something.
Omega has fallen.
Yeah. I will say this. If a character that I would like to have seen killed that I did not, I wish it had been Blue Streak on the shuttle instead of Prowl. Blue Streak really just got on my nerves sometimes.
Just so we have an excuse to not bring back Casey Kasem?
No, it's just an unrelated reason. Yeah, it's just for some reason, Blue Streak just, I don't know, just, I don't know.
Unnecessary.
Yeah, it's just I would have rather have seen Blue Streak than it be Prowl, but better Prowl than Smokescreen.
One kind of came to me, but I think it wasn't so much that I wanted him to die, but I think maybe if he stayed dead, it would have maybe had a better impact. Ultra Magnus, maybe. I think that the rebuilding of the simplicity of the rebuilding of Ultra Magnus after, you know, we see Prime die, we see all these characters die, Ultra Magnus is blown to smithereens. And then no fuss, no muss, hurry, you know?
Yeah.
It was
Now that could have been the result of the mashup of scripts.
Oh, totally. Well, that's something that, like you mentioned before, the fact that he was pulled apart instead of, like, just shot and killed.
Jim mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, where it almost lends more to that, where, yeah, an arm and a leg, cleanly separated by four sweeps, you know? Makes that rebuild, I guess, if you want to be technological with robots, the rebuild much more realistic than shot multiple times in the chest.
It's only a flesh wound. You're missing an arm.
I just never could understand as a kid whenever I finally saw the movie. And you see Prime die, and then later on in the movie, Ultra Magnus is literally blown to bits. I mean, Prime just got beat up really bad, and he dies on the table. And then here, Ultra Magnus is like literally he's in multiple pieces, and the Junkions are like, oh, let's just put him back together, and he's alive again.
Some turtle wax, and he's good to go.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here as a kid, and I'm like, why don't they just go find Prime, bring him there, have him fix the same way, and boom, everything's good again, you know? Yeah.
And here's the thing about that with Prime. Yes, Ratchet is dead. Fix-It doesn't exist yet, probably. We never saw Hoist, but you have Perceptor.
Or standing, red alert.
Standing right there. It's like, Perceptor, you can't put him on life support. You can't Scotty MacGyver something to keep him alive. You're freaking Perceptor. Do something. And you just stand there and he just, oh, I can't do anything.
So what? Don wants Perceptor dead pretty much.
No. Well, through the years, my fanboy rage has got the better of me, but I like Perceptor. He's a geek like me. He's a science geek. But it's like, you're standing, yeah, the wounds are fatal. Try something anyway.
Maybe clone him?
Yeah. Just don't do something. Stand there.
Maybe pour some Coralstop down in his gas tank or something, you know? But if I had one character that I would put on the kill list instead of the do not kill list, we would probably not, well, according to the cartoon, we would not have a future character. And I say this because, not because I hate the character, but more so that character death, as we found out with Optimus Prime, can help resonate with the fans even more. I mean, it happens. I mean, you know, like when Captain Kirk dies in Star Trek Generations, you know, it's one of those things that as a fan, it really hits you home because you have attached to that character so much. But could you imagine if Bumblebee had been killed in the movie and never brought back?
You know, I think that would have carried as much emotional weight as Prime.
I agree.
To a lot of people, because, you know, because in the first three-parter, it looks like Hound is going to be the audience identification character along with Spike, because it's him and Spike throughout the whole movie. And then all of a sudden, boom, you've got Bumblebee for the entire course of season one and season two that's hanging out with Spike. So, I mean, his death, I mean, if we had saw his death instead of, say,
Braun.
Well, yeah, if Braun had been on the show, Bumblebee instead of Braun, or let's just say we drop the scene where we see Wheeljack and Windcharger and just them being off, we don't know about them, and then have that be a Bumblebee death scene, like, you know, Starscream just carpet bombs him or something, and then all you see is his Autobot symbol on his like little wheel cover rolling away. That's all you ever see again.
Well, imagine this. And this is going back to what Sergio pointed out. I think it was Sergio that pointed out how brutal the scene was on the shuttle. Oh, could you imagine Megatron blowing away Bumblebee the same way he did Ironhide? But, I mean, Ironhide was a warrior. He was a grizzled veteran and everything. And even though it was brutal, we accepted it more because in our minds, even as kids, we saw Ironhide as somebody that, yeah, he was knocked down, but at some point, he could have fought back. But Bumblebee was a little espionage guy that really couldn't defend himself. He was the smallest of Autobots. He was the innocent little, the little guy. He was just the messenger boy. And
it really was.
Could you imagine Megatron blowing him away just so irreverently? You know, just, I mean, you mean nothing, you know, and blowing him away. I mean, it would have devastated children.
And that's the reality. That's the reality, especially because you look at who Megatron killed in that shuttle. He killed Braun, who could be arguably the second strongest Autobot of the 84 Autobots outside of Prime, you know, in terms of physical strength. Then you're talking about killing Prowl, second in command, so, you know, security officer. Ratchet, yeah, that's the low blow. That's like, oh, killing a medical officer. That's kind of like, you know, even though Ratchet was shooting like crazy. And then Ironhide, that's, you know, he died a warrior's death, you know. So,
but the thing I always –
being in that mix of those four would have been the real sore thumb out of all of that.
But to make it even worse – as far as a character death, and this is pouring salt and vinegar into an open wound. Scavenger is the one that kills Prowl. Scavenger,
I know,
of all people. Imagine if it had been Scavenger killing Bumblebee. He doesn't even get killed by Megatron. He gets killed by Scavenger.
Someone's got to pull up a tech spec profile. What's his firepower on that one?
Probably like a 3.
Yeah, seriously.
All he has is like a little pistol, you know?
Yeah.
That's another thing that always got me about that scene is like, okay, they're shooting them with their normal pistols and everything.
6, not bad.
How did they get so damn powerful with the but it was explained at the beginning of the movie that the Decepticons had conquered the homeworld of the planet Cybertron. So I'm assuming at some point between 1985 and the year 2005, in that 20-year gap, yeah. I'm assuming that the Decepticons had found some way to boost their power. Or boost their firepower,
and also taking target practice.
Thing that Flint Dilley talked about in the DVD extras of the one of the first DVD releases of I think it was the 20th anniversary DVD release where he did an audio commentary.
Yes.
And one thing that was really interesting that he covered on was something that was very absent from the script that they were really trying to emphasize. It was only a visual thing, but it wasn't something that was narrated. Was that the Autobots on Earth had an extreme advantage in the sense that they had they were making Energon easily through hydropower and wind power, and there's this amazing someone had this amazing shot. It was like a pan shot of Autobot City from the 86 movie using just the background cells, and you could see next to Autobot City was these gigantic dams that were generating hydroelectricity, and you look even more so and you see wind electricity also, these giant wind-powered and I guess that – I don't know what the Decepticons were using at the time to fund their war, but the Autobots had an extreme advantage of energy. That's why there's that famous line, we need you to make an Energon run to Autobot City, because Autobot City was the primary source of Energon being created there, and it wasn't really – in your face established in the 86 movie, but it was present there. I'm going to try to find the image of it. Maybe you could post it on the,
I know the image you're talking about.
Yeah, it's really nice. It came from one of the original animation cells, and someone just they took off the layer of the front cell and they just had the background, and it really shows beautifully painted what was kind of like not narrated about how the Autobots had an edge. I'm going to try to find it.
Well, but, you know, looking at it from probably too critical of an eye, that's when you have a space bridge, and you space bridge the crap to your moon base instead of doing an actual
– Is that it?
Instead of doing a bear run for Energon.
Here we go. I found it. Nice.
Is this the image, Spider-Man?
He's going to share it, I think, here.
Oh, let me see.
Okay. I just want to make sure that was the right one.
And open up the window where we
– I mean,
yeah, that's the one. That's okay. The one.
Thumbs up.
Yeah, maybe post that one. It really shows, like, you know, how there was just, you know, there was like an intent of like that kind of story, and it, you know, maybe the Decepticons, yeah, maybe they realized their guns were on safety all this time. I don't know.
Yeah, and just imagine how different the movie would be if Metroplex had transformed.
Mm.
Just imagine that, you know, that they actually went ahead and went that route and. You know, which actually, because Slammer's already there.
You watch the original Japanese trailer, and it's like that Autobot City was primarily white and very Metroplex in design when it transforms. And there's only snippets and pieces of it used in the actual 86 movie.
But even the tank Slammer is already there in the movie, you know, being deployed. So it's like Metroplex has his robot mode probably at that point. But, you know, they just retconned it by saying his cog was destroyed.
The cog was damaged.
Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you damage his cog when it's like inside the city and you never got inside the city?
Metroplex's eye for Unicron's eye, apparently. So come on, man. It's all modular. Season 3 was a weird beast. Yeah.
Well, I think we've talked enough about the 86 movie. I mean, it's
could never talk enough. Know,
well, as far as tonight goes.
Yeah.
As I said to Flint whenever we led into the intro, I can't believe it's been 30 years.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I really wasn't even cognizant of the fact that the 30th anniversary was coming up. I knew we had the 25th. I mean, I've got the 25th anniversary DVD in here. I think it is the 25th, the one that was put out by, I think, Sony. the one with the pink hot rod in it.
Yeah, that was the 20th anniversary.
Wow, it's been 10 years since that came.
I know, eh?
Imagine.
I know.
You know, before you know it, we're going to be hitting 40 in half a century. You know, so yeah,
just imagine with the 50-year anniversary. Of course, I'll probably be dead and gone by then. But just imagine what the 50th anniversary could boast in 20 years with the technology. You know, just it boggles. I mean, you know, we'll get actual, you know, it'll be a hologram version, but it'll be, you know, like Futurama. It'll be a black and white hologram because you have to sort of start all over.
We can only hope that we'll have that kind of technology in 20 years. Sometimes I feel like we failed what we hoped the future would be, aka what the 86 movie was showing us.
Well,
still waiting for that hoverboard.
One of the things that Flint actually, and this is to quote him from his Facebook feed, he quoted, it sure didn't feel like a classic at the time whenever they were making it. He even said that earlier on the show here. It didn't feel like a classic at the time. All he remembers from the premiere was that there was a guy sitting behind him cussing frequently, and turns out that that guy was one of the sound mixers, and he was hearing all the sound problems that that made it through to the final version of the film. So at that time, it really didn't they really didn't know that they were making what would become a cult classic, and. You know, there nobody knew then that 30 years from then that we'd be talking about it on podcasts, on you know, in big groups, and having guests and on at conventions,
or the
all because of this movie.
Yeah, just
or a $1 billion franchise movie.
Yeah.
So a movie that failed financially has gone on to probably keeping the franchise alive in the years in which it was not as viable as it is now.
You know, and many other fans may even think of this connection too. There was another big popular franchise today that nobody can deny is one of the most popular franchises of all time. And it started with a series that was ultimately deemed as a failure. And didn't become, in its reruns, became a cult classic.
Firefly.
Star Trek.
I know, I was kidding.
Firefly. You know, and I very much see Transformers, and specifically Generation 1 Transformers, as a Star Trek of sorts. I mean, yeah, we don't have the following that, say, Star Trek has, but it started what has become a phenomenon. With, like Sergio said, $1 billion movie franchises, you know, lucrative toys. That, I mean, Transformers is a anchor for Hasbro now. Where's G.I. Joe? You know, so I mean, you know, Transformers is an anchor for this brand now. They, you know, I mean, there's fan companies that are rising up and creating unofficial toys. Because there's such a demand for these characters.
Well, I will say one thing real quick. I know this is about the movie, but you can also see the failings of the movie impacting G.I. Joe the following year, mm-hmm. and the changes they made. But for all, I'm not a huge Joe fan, but I have to say the opening scene to G.I. Joe, that awesome. Opening is probably one of the finest pieces of animation out there in terms of just being fun.
I have stuck in the G.I. Joe movie DVD simply to watch the opening.
Exactly. I will say this now. When it makes a Canadian look at that American flag and go, you know what? That's pretty fucking cool. You know?
Yeah.
That says something, okay? So the Canadian could look at yeah. Duke with the flag on the Statue of Liberty and go, you know what? That's pretty freaking cool. That's something right there.
Exactly. So, I mean, the Transformers 86 movie even affected other movies later on down the road, not just as in its own little universe. So that's something to say too.
But yeah, I mean, and it could be argued too, going back to the G.I. Joe thing. The influences on G.I. Joe, it could be argued that because of what happened in Transformers, could it possibly be the reason that G.I. Joe is never really reached that height of popularity again? Because they made those changes to the G.I. Joe movie, so it didn't resonate as long. I mean, G.I. Joe really never had its Beast Wars and resurgence.
It did, but I think that, and I've said that, I've had this discussion many times with different groups of people. I found that G.I. Joe was, and Joe fans could attack me for this, but I found that G.I. Joe was too much a product of its time. And it did have its place in small markets, but I found when it would try to be something that was broad, G.I. Joe Extreme, Sigma 6, when they tried to bring it back with the Cobra versus G.I. Joe toy line and CG cartoons, when children wanted to play Army, that generation of children, they go to Call of Duty. They go to Halo. They go to – there's. I think that for Joe to survive today, it would have to do to itself what Beast Wars did to G1, which it would have to reinvent itself so much that it might anger – just like how G1ers didn't like Beast Wars initially and was angry about it. But at the same time, Beast Wars in a lot of ways saved Transformers and brought it into a new era and made it just as popular as it was in 1985 when it reached its peak back then.
And then once it gains a foothold, then make its ties to the original.
Yeah, of course. Well, but where it's the same way, I think Joe would have to reinvent itself in such a huge way. I like one suggestion a lot of people made. I think it was Joshua Perez from IDW said it the best. Like, mix it with Mask. You know, you got to put something that changes the Joe formula where it's not just good guys versus bad guys, because that's what it really is, what it boils down to. You know, you could say, oh, terrorist organization, Army, but it really was a very simple good guys versus bad guys thing. And I love G.I. Joe, especially as a Canadian. I love G.I. Joe. I love the movie. I love the original series. It was very well written. Larry Hama is an amazing writer. But at the same time, it's something that is very hard to pull from that timeline. You could take G1 and remake it only very so slightly, and it still works today. You know, like, there's nothing 80s about, you know, Spike or Optimus Prime. You know, giant robots and stuff are 80s incarnate, but there's nothing strictly reserved to the 80s about anything Transformers did in G1.
Yeah, and that's what I've been begging for. You know, I mean, that's what I've been begging for. I mean, yeah, we're getting G1 style characters in Combiner Wars and Titan Returns and stuff. Basically, what I've been begging for as a collector for years, we're finally getting those. I'm not bitching about all the repaints and retools and stuff. I love these characters because they are very, very faithful, for the most part, updates to the original characters. And I would love for them to, okay, instead of just making a new cartoon, like, okay, let's do RID 2.0, RID 3.0, you know, more Transformers Prime, more animated and everything. Okay, let's go back. And Combiner Wars is sort of doing it, but it's more of a comic continuity.
It's more IDW's story.
But I would love to see them go back and say, okay, you know, people love these characters. We've reintroduced them now. They're fresh in people's minds. We've reintroduced people to the Technobots, the idea of the Combiners and Menasor and Bruticus and Power Masters and Headmasters. Okay, let's go back and redo Generation 1. Have like Generation 1 reboot, but set it in modern times. Maybe update the looks of the characters, but essentially have the same core there.
And
have
the characters. Thing, in all honesty, Duran, is that if you did that, you wouldn't even really have to change that much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, outside of Soundwave being a cassette player, which he really was a micro cassette player anyway, and, you know, maybe Reflector being a cell phone camera now, there's not much that you would have to, you know, again, what has been done many times before. They looked at G1 with alternators and they said, well, I guess, you know, they're modern cars now. And they did that with IDW initially with, I believe it was Devastation, Escalation and stuff, where, you know, they attached those cars to, you know, like Jazz to a modern Porsche and stuff like that. But outside of those mild, we'll call it marketing updates, which would be, modern Porsche, modern this, modern that. Nothing else would change from a storytelling standpoint, from a overall storytelling standpoint, from a character standpoint. Characters would not have to be changed to fit into modern era.
They don't even have to come up with new characters.
Was never offensive then. He's not offensive now. Neither was any other characters, nor were they dated. You know, someone like Blaster, which was like a very 80s disc jockey, still would be enjoyable today as a character, if anything, as a character in itself, not even making that connection to an 80s disc jockey back then, which are practically like extinct today, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, and see, Generation 1 had so many characters in it, some that weren't even fleshed out, but they were characters that were introduced, mm-hmm. that they literally don't even have to come up with new characters. They could have Optimus Prime and Megatron, and there's and swap out their rotating cast of characters that were in Generation 1.
That's the credit that I've always given to Animated, is that Animated, I felt, because Derek Wyatt was such a fan of Generation 1, that he made sure that if a character from Generation 1 appeared, he would try to make it as true to that vision of that G1 character as much as possible. And it always went over. It always did well. Mm-hmm. If a character like, Blur appeared, or the one line that a certain character would have, let's say, if Mirage would have been in the series, or alternatively, if Prowl would have, been a different character, because Lord knows he went through different design changes. You know, they tried to be as true to the original as possible. But anyways, we're getting on off a tangent right now. But
I think this would make excellent fodder for another new episode.
Totally.
Talking about what ifs and everything, and we'll put it on the back burner and maybe put it out there.
Yeah.
I want to remind people that if you haven't watched it, check out our YouTube channel. You can watch our videos live every week at 9 p.m. Eastern or thereabouts on 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube, the video version. So if we're talking about something, you want to see it, or you want to see what we look like, how ugly we are. I mean, look at Jim. Golly. I mean, I don't know what happened there. But
a very large hammer.
If you want to see us, I mean, check out our YouTube channel. We got hundreds of videos up there. Last week, I had a really awesome interview at TF Expo, and I want to thank again Phil Searle and Aaron Haynes for allowing me the opportunity to interview Mr. David Kay, the voice of Beast Wars Megatron and Animated Optimus Prime. It was an absolute pleasure to interview Mr. Kay, and look forward to having him on the show again at a future date. But check out that, and the audio version is also on iTunes now and Google Plus, or Google Play rather. So wherever your podcast consumption occurs, that's where we are. I want to thank everybody for joining us for this 30th anniversary discussion of Transformers: A Movie. I want to thank Flint Dilley, who wasn't able to rejoin us after his phone died, but he provided some great little insight into the writing and some of the ideas on the behind the scenes of Transformers: The Movie from 1986, an iconic film. And if you haven't seen it, shame on you. If you consider yourself a Transformer fan, go watch it. It is 80s-tastic, but absolutely awesome.
Just don't drink while watching it. Things may
matter of fact. Do drink while watching it, because it'll actually make some parts of it make sense. but that being said, it'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. It'll make you say, "Oh shit, what are we going to do now?" We'll see you next time on Transformers for Your Listening Pleasure. I am Deron Land with Daniel,
John, boys,
Sergio, and Jim. We will see you next time on TFYOP. Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Bye, guys.
This has been Transformers for Your Listening Pleasure, a presentation of TFTalk.net. We'd like to thank you for listening and ask that you please rate us on your favorite podcast outlet and share us with your friends. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at TFYLP. Email us at podcast
at tfylp.com. This is Paul Lighting, and on behalf of TFYLP, we'd like to thank you again for listening. And we hope you'll join us next time for another TFYLP.